This is a Sound Rebel podcast.
To work with us on your podcast, go to soundrebel.co.uk. Over the Influence is no longer just a podcast. Our online community is buzzing with people like you.
My name is Kerry and I'm from Lancashire. And I first started listening to the OTI podcast about 2 years ago. I've been really looking at wanting to change my daily drinking for a few years and really felt like I needed to change my relationship with alcohol. So I binge listened to the podcast, which I thought were fantastic, and then heard about the OTI community. So I joined up when I started off doing Sober October. Really, it's been an absolute game changer. The community is just amazing. It picks you up if you're feeling a bit down. The members support you and they celebrate your wins. I really don't think I would have been where I am now if it wasn't for the OTI community. So all I can say is give it a go. What have you got to lose?
You've heard the podcast. Now join the conversation. Go to overtheinfluence.co.uk. Welcome to Over the Influence. We are officially, yes, officially, the world's largest, fastest growing, bestest in the world ever alcohol-free podcast. So welcome. And it is thank you to you listening that we have had literally a squillion downloads. We couldn't do this without you. Before we introduce this evening's guests, a quick recap as to who we are. If you are just tuning in for the first time, and if you are just tuning in for the first time, where have you been? There are so many episodes to go at. We've got series one, we've got series two, and then we stopped doing the series and we went weekly. So you can fill your boots, just go back and start from the beginning. Loads and loads of alcohol-free nonsense to go at. My name is Sharon Hartley. Nobody calls me Sharon. Call me Shaz. Call me Shazar. Ben will no doubt do an impression about me somewhere during the course of this podcast. I hope so, because it does make me laugh. What can I tell you about me? I stopped drinking 3 years and 2 months ago-ish, something like that. I can see our guests cheering in the corner. Thank you very much. Didn't think I could do 3 days, and I did. And actually, I'm going through an awful time at the moment because Facebook Memories is reminding me of how I used to be at the end of Sober October. And let me tell you, horrific. So it's like, delete that post, delete that post, delete that post. Anywho, enough about me. I am 3 years sober, loving life, will never, ever, ever go back to boozing like I did. It is life-changing stuff and it is just a joy to sing about sobriety on this podcast. In the future, in tomorrow, is my glamorous co-host, Young Freddie. Good morning, Young Freddie.
Hello, Young Shazza. It's not so Young Freddie here, and I am very sweaty and very out of breath, and I'll tell you why, because this is to do with my introduction. With the time difference, I've just sprinted to get my kids to school, sprinted out the school to get here to for the best part of my week to speak to you all, except the headmaster pulled me back and he was like, "Oi, Bennett!" I was like, "Oh God, I'm 11 years old again." And he was like, and it's never a good thing when the headmaster of your kid's school says, "I've been looking at your Instagram."
And oh, think, oh God, no.
And he was like, "So what's this thing with you and alcohol?" And I was like, "Right, well, Mr. Headmaster, sir, I used to be a rather heavy drinker. I used to be rather stressed and depressed. And to deal with that, I used to throw quite a lot of booze down my throat, sir. And but, sir, I stopped almost 1,000 days ago. And since then, life is a lot better. I'm happier. I'm calmer. I'm in New Zealand, which is something else that wouldn't have happened. But I decided to see what I was capable of. And I wanted to see what life would be like if I really fulfilled my potential. And that is why I gave up drinking. And that's why I'm here in the future." And then he said, "Right, very good, Bennett, on your way." And I said, "Thank you, sir." And I sprinted down the hill. And now I'm here.
Freddie, as always, it's an absolute pleasure. Ben is our podcast producer. He attempts to keep myself and Freddie in check. He's a sensible grown-up sometimes in this operation. He likes to underline things and put things in bold and caps lock, and he loves a number. We used to call him Background Ben. No more is he in the background. He came to the foreground when he stopped drinking, and he's very, very sober. Ben, hello.
Hello. Yes, I gave up booze. When I started this podcast, when I started producing this podcast, I was not alcohol free. I was doing the podcast and then going home and cracking a beer, which is not great.
But you always said that is it?
No, but you guys said you didn't care that I you didn't just wanted care. A good podcast.
Absolutely.
Producer.
Yeah. We liked you, and we were not in the least bit arsed that you drank. Not a problem at all.
But then, you know, after hours and hours of listening to Freddie and Chaz talk about how fantastic alcohol-free life was, and with a lot of support from friends and family, he said, actually, you know what? It's probably a good thing this Over the Influence thing's come into your life, because we've been a bit worried about you drinking recently. I decided to knock it on the head, and I'm now 15 months. No, 16. It'll be 16 months this week. I've been alcohol free for, and I love it. It's completely changed my life, and I think that, you know, I wasn't a ridiculously heavy drinker all the time, but when I did go out, I hit it hard. I drank twice as fast as everybody else, and I wasn't an alcoholic, I don't think, when I gave up alcohol. Having said that, I was using alcohol for the wrong reasons. It wasn't fun. It was because I was stressed and I wanted to escape. And if you give me a few more years, then my relationship with alcohol was only going one way. And delighted to be, you know, clearer headed, lighter, brighter, generally just a more positive, optimistic person now that I've ditched booze for good. And I can say that because I'd be stupid to go back to drinking again now. My life's changed in so many ways, work wise, family wise. I love it. And I love this podcast, and I love our guests.
We love you too. We really do love your story. In fact, you know what? On our production meeting, Freddie, I'd like to get Ben on as a guest at some point in the future.
We definitely should. In the premium podcast, we've uncovered Ben, haven't we? We've had an intimate expose of Ben on the premium one for our members. But yeah, maybe we should. Yeah, I certainly won't either. Wow. And but your girlfriend must be happy. I think it must be.
Our community is a very serious place. It's full of supportive, good, and useful resources. There was no nakedness in any of that Zoom call, just to clarify. It was an expose in terms of I bared my soul, and that was
all
that was bared.
Yes. I'm going to move on.
Good.
I would love to welcome our guest to this slick, professional, alcohol-free podcast. Now, I don't really know how to introduce you. Now, don't take this rudely, because we're coming at this from a different angle this evening. And normally I would go, right, this is such a body, and this is what you've done, and this is where you've come from. But we're not using your name on the podcast. I'm going to introduce you as Person Irresponsible. And I want you to take over from this point forward so I don't make an absolute hash of it. So Person Irresponsible, welcome to Over the Influence. It is wonderful to have you here, first of all. Can we just start with that? Why are we calling you Person Irresponsible on the podcast rather than your name?
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me. I'm so excited to be here as well. I'm just dying to tell you a story that I live in the Cotswolds, which is terribly la-di-da. And I live in one of those villages with that, you know, thatched cottages, and it's got this green and all the houses around the green. You can imagine how it is. And I've written a book, and in that book, I have confessed to certain things that I would never dream of telling a stranger face to face. And one of those things is I'm a recovering alcoholic with AA. And so, of course, I'm now promoting this book, and all the village have bought this book one way or another. So now they all know I am the local drunk. And in the village, there's a park bench, and I daren't sit on it because they'll go, there's the park bench drunk. One of the reasons I stick with PI is to maintain my anonymity. And I got sober with AA, other systems are available. And despite what everyone thinks, you don't have to be this park bench drunk to join AA. You just have to have a desire to stop drinking. But if you are going to admit that you are in AA, on a one-to-one basis, that's absolutely fine. But at the level of press, radio and film, you do, it's requested, it's strongly requested, we maintain our anonymity. So for that reason alone, I have stuck with what is known as my trail name, which is what a through hiker, that's someone who walks and cross an entire country, they get trail names, or we give ourselves trail names. And my trail name was PI, or Person Irresponsible, because I walked across America in a pandemic whilst sober.
OMG.
Wow.
Well, that shut us all up, PI. Yeah.
I should also add, I was 4 years something sober, well, coming up 4 years sober. I was female, I was fat, and I was 40 something and slightly fucked as well.
All the F's. Oh. Oh my god. So I think, well, where to start? We've got so much to talk about on this episode of Over the Influence. Thank you so much, and thank you for explaining the reason behind your, I'll take a big run-up at this because I can't say the word, anonymity. It is wonderful to have you here. I think actually, Ben and Freddie, this is the first time we've spoken to somebody that has been through AA and gone to AA and used that as their recovery tool, which is fantastic. And I'm really, really interested in chatting to you about this. I know people might have mentioned it in the past, I think. Ben, am I right? Yeah. Or
no, we've definitely spoken to people who've, you know, taken on the kind of 12 principles and, you know, used elements of it and gone to meetings, I think, for sure.
Gone to meetings, yeah. And I think so done other things as well.
Would you mind explain the difference there, PI?
Yeah, I mean, basically, there's all sorts of ways that people refer to it. You know, when you're in AA, you might talk about being in the rooms. And that actually just means I'm a member of the fellowship of AA or NA or CA. And NA is Narcotics Anonymous, CA is cocaine. There's Overeaters Anonymous. They're all 12-step-based programs. And so, and they are all there to help an individual overcome addiction. And the philosophy behind it is that one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic can communicate on with understanding and compassion in a way that a non-alcoholic cannot. You know, people who want to talk to us about our drinking, as we would say, frothy emotional appeals, they just don't work straight over. Rational arguments don't work. But sit down with somebody else that's struggled with drinking and you get on a level that you just don't in ordinary life. So that's a big part of it. So, yeah, so you'll hear people call it the fellowship or in the rooms and so on. But most people don't actually talk about it. Most people really are quite confined. They, you know, people obviously know, but the anonymity part and is really adhered to. So it's to protect newcomers mostly, because there's nothing worse than when, I don't know how it was for you guys, but when I got to the end of my drinking, I was so ashamed. I was so, yeah, I didn't want to tell anybody I had this drinking problem, and I'd probably had it for years. Or at that point, I was convinced I'd only had it for 2 years and it was my ex-husband's fault. But I was just, I didn't want to go to a doctor. I didn't want to, you know, pay any money. I didn't want to go to rehab. I wasn't that bad. I needed to go to rehab. And then it was just a series of things that happened. And I came across AA and I discovered it was free. So I was like, oh, yay. And I discovered, you know, and I'd rung this helpline and I said, look, I don't want to tell anyone my name and I don't want anyone to recognize me. And she said, listen, for all we care, you can call yourself Mary Poppins. There's no forms to fill in. And if you see somebody in AA that recognizes you, you're recognizing them. And if you didn't know that they were in there, that's because they didn't want you to know. And it was like, oh, okay. So the anonymity thing, we are really protective over. So some people, a bit like me, you know, I will tell a few people that I'm in AA, I have no problem with it, but it's just nobody's business. So I just don't bother telling anyone, you know, and I've always stuck with that. I'm also vegetarian. It's none of your bloody business either. And I also wear, you know, well, I used to wear size 5 shoes, but since I walked across America, they're size 6. And that's nobody's business either. And
what happened to your feet?
I dropped 3 dress sizes and then put on 4 when I came back.
I think the AA perspective is such an important one because, yeah, I think Shazra and Ben are right. We talk about it a lot on Over the Influence, and it's difficult to talk about sobriety without AA coming into there at some point in the conversation. But But we haven't had anyone that's as deeply integrated into AA as yourself. And there's one thing that you said there I found is really interesting, where you talked about the importance of, the importance of anonymity keeping your identity to yourself and everything else. But then you contrast that with social media these days. How do you find in the 21st century, when everything seems to be online, where nothing is private or secret anymore, seemingly, is that quite nice to have this anonymity around AA and just keeping it within that room and within that circle?
Yeah. To some extent, yes. I mean, I think it's more to do with, it's twofold. When we all come in, we're all totally paranoid, and the shame and the stigma and the guilt, I felt it really intensely, and I don't think I'm alone with that. So it gives that sense of security and safety that you're fine to talk about all the shameful stuff you've done here, because we've all probably done it too, and you're going to hear stories from people who have done far, far worse than you think you have done as well, which kind of brings its own comfort. And the other reason, we have to remember AA was contrived sort of in the late 1939, where the stigma was much, much worse than it is today. Social media is breaking down those barriers really effectively and taking shame out. And we're so much more aware of the pernicious nature of shame now that you know, we weren't several decades ago. So times are changing. I think there is still some judgmentalism. If I talk to people who are, say, teetotal, they'll always go, yes, I'm teetotal, but I'm not an alcoholic. You know, and you're like, okay, well, I am. And so there's still that sort of stigma and those issues and those stereotypes around it. And like I say, I was never the park bench drunk. I never drank every night of the week. I never drank before 6 o'clock. So there's still that stereotype. But the other reason for AA and being sort of so anonymous and we're so protective of it is, if I was to relapse, and it does happen, if I was to start drinking again, it would send out the message that actually recovery doesn't work. And actually it does work. It's just that maybe I am not working it, if that makes sense. Because I've come to believe that the drink is always going to be there. We live in an alcohol saturated society. And so it's like you say, you go through a bad time and it's often the first thought is, oh, well, I'll go and get drunk on this. So it's that sense of if it was just, I don't want to misrepresent AA and say, oh, it doesn't actually work, because it does. And it works for loads and loads of people. So it's that kind of protecting the society rather than the individual, if that makes sense. So that's sort of the logic behind it. But it is a fellowship. And for me, it's become, like you say, it's growing now that teetotalism is becoming more like a fashion, like veganism is, and all sorts of other things. So it's getting easier to be sober in modern day society. You're no longer the freak show at the party that's sitting there drinking a glass of water. Other spirits are available, you know. And so, yeah, so it's getting, it's not quite as bad as it used to be, but I can still go to, whatever social do, and they'll be like, oh, you don't drink, do you? And it's like, no, I don't.
Do you find, though, that saying, I mean, you may or may not, but if someone starts off on that line that we've all heard before, when someone say, oh, don't you drink? Oh, that's a bit boring. Why don't you drink? And we all kind of roll our eyes. Do you ever find that just turning around to them and saying, I'm in AA, does that really shut them down? Or that's a tactic I've tried to do before.
I have three ways of dealing with it. To be fair, it doesn't happen as often as you think it happens. So very, like I say, occasionally somebody will ask me, and I have three responses. First of all is I slap a great big smile on my face and I just look them in the eye and I say, oh, yeah, it's because I'm a raging alcoholic. And they think I'm hilarious. So they just don't take me seriously. The other response I sometimes choose to have is, in AA, the reaction that alcoholics have is, if you have one drink, then it creates this thirst for a second drink, which creates a thirst for a third drink. And that reaction, that chain reaction, which means it's never enough. You never, unless you pass out, do you know what I mean? You're just going to carry on drinking. It's called an allergy. And it just means unusual reaction. So sometimes with people, I'll just look at them and say, oh, I'm allergic to alcohol. And they'll go, oh, I'm so sorry, that's so tragic. And it's like, yeah, it's really tragic. And of course, I'm telling the truth, but they don't know. And a third time, sometimes I just say, oh, I'm a recovering alcoholic. And they'll just you know, straight away it turns you into a Catholic priest in their eyes, and they confess they're drinking to you. And all of a sudden you think, God, there's nothing more boring than listening to the amateurs describe their drinking, because I'm so used to hearing war stories in AA. So, you know, so it's like, where's the cop cars and where's the bonkers purchases and where's, you know, the the mad people that you woke up with in the morning, you know, where's all those stories? And they're just like, well, I have
I
to.
I love that. I think we, if we, let's all do that now. We're the pros in this game. Don't come in our territory, you party goers, with your little half glass of wine. Say like, oh, don't you drink? Come back when you're ready to play with the big boys. Amateurs in that game. We're the pros. Stay out of our territory. That's amazing.
When you have woken up having drunkenly purchased a jet ski, having never ridden one in your life, you know you have a drink problem. Until you can compete with that story, I don't want to hear it.
P.I., can we talk about how you found AA then? And like, because you've referred to it as the fellowship, obviously, yep. The anonymity side of it. I believe there's some religious elements to AA as well. Am I right in that?
Not really. Yes and no. The twofold issue. It is mistaken as a religious thing for two reasons. One, the 12 steps uses the word God. Now, God can be anything from group of drunks right through to a monolithic God, Christian base, whatever, who cares? And so it's more spiritual than it is religious. So we talk about prayer and meditation, but what you pray to and what you meditate about is entirely down to you. And that's, you know, that's the first thing we all learn is like when you get into AA is don't worry about what's over there until it's over here, because we'll all look at the God word and freak out. I mean, I certainly did. And the second thing is a lot of the meetings take place in church halls. So you assume it's affiliated with the church. But actually, it's because church rent is really, really cheap. A meeting can cost as little as sort of, I don't know, £6 to £8 at a session. And when you've got 10 or 20, 30 people plus in a room, that's pence to pay for. If people wanted to spend more money on it, we could have our meetings in the Hilton, but no bugger wants to spend that much money. So it is misconstrued as religion. So you'll hear other people, you know, God can be quite an uncomfortable word. So you'll hear God as you understand it, her, him, or higher power, or so on and so forth. But there's plenty of atheists and in AA. And it's one of those senses that everybody is welcome. No, there's no hidden religion backing this. It's not like, I know with some charities, it's like a one particular religion behind it. Yes, its roots are in Midwest America, Bible Belt America, and so on and so forth. But generally speaking, no, it's the higher power thing. If you're going to take the steps, you come to learn that, yes, you know, I had to deal with it in the sense of I didn't know what I believed in. So I had to just form a relationship with something. So I moved from being highly skeptical to being more agnostic, if you like. But I don't go to church. I don't, you know, there's no fear of me knocking on your door and saying, hello, come with me. Or anything like that. So, yeah, so the big myth is that it's religion based. But what you'll generally hear in AA is that religion is for people who fear hell and spirituality is for people who have been there. And AA, of course, we've all been to hell and back with our drinking. So it tends to be a bit more spiritual. Of course, there's, you know, deeply religious people in AA because there are in every walk of life.
Yeah. There does seem, with the fellowship, the anonymity and all that, it almost feels like people can sometimes be a little scared to take that first jump with AA and make the phone call or turn up at the meeting because of those kind of, as you say, the myths around it.
You think you're joining a cult. I mean, that was my first thought was, oh my God, I found myself in this cult. And before you know it, I'm going to be sacrificed on the altar. So it can, and there's all this sort of archaic language as well. It's like joining any club. It sort of takes a while to get into the swing of things. So we always just say, look, go to not just one meeting. Meetings are like pubs. So I didn't like every pub I ever went to. I'm not going to like every meeting I go to. So go to a wide selection of meetings and then go to the ones that really chime with you. So like if you're a woman, go to a meeting that's got tons of women in it. And so you sort of find your own feet with it. And put any sort of preconditions or prejudices to one side, because the reality is it's a safe place to talk about something that's trying to kill you. And that's the real big issue here is that once you've got onto that path of alcoholism or heavy drinking, whatever, you know, because I wasn't an alcoholic when I joined AA, I just had a big drinking problem. And it's very important to me to you understood that difference. I have no idea what the difference is anymore, but at the time it's very important. And I had to just basically put any preconceived ideas of, to one side, because it was like something about this is working for me, even though I don't know what it is. And there was something about just sitting in a meeting with these people talking so openly and so honestly that put me at ease, and it made me feel okay or slightly better about myself than I'd felt for quite a long time. So if you are like struggling with your drinking and you're looking for support, there's, you know, there is Smart Recovery, there is AA, there's various huge number of Facebook, you know, clubs and whatever societies you can join. So there's tons, but AA is often seen for people that are at the end of the line. Do you know what I mean? Once you've tried everything else. I was just bloody lucky and mean, to be honest. I didn't want to spend any money on myself. But once I found out AA was practically free, it was like, I'm going there. And once I realized it was anonymous, I didn't have to fill in a single form. I didn't have to tell my doctor. And as a woman, I think that can be quite a barrier. If you've got young children, for example, you don't want to tell anyone that you've got a drink problem because you're terrified social services are going to knock on your door the next day. So something like AA is brilliant because you don't have to tell anybody anything about yourself. You can just go sit in the back of the room, sit in the center of the room for all anybody cares, and just listen and just see if you can relate to anybody else's story. And I'd grown up in an alcoholic home as well, so I didn't realize how traumatic that was until I got into recovery. And so I was, you know, I was used to keeping secrets and things. And I remember the first thing I was so shocked about when I joined AA is everybody was really open. They were open about their insecurities, they were open about their shame, they were open about their guilt. And I was horrified, but it was like, actually, that's what I need. The reasons I drank were to hide my shame, hide my guilt, hide my discomfort in my own skin. And so once you're in an environment where other people are showing you, look, we're really healthy and happy, it's like, okay, what did you do? I'll do the same, you know, and it becomes easier because you're in a collective of non-judgmental people, if that makes sense, on the issue around drinking. So, yeah.
I think it makes total sense. And to pick up something that you said there and right at the start as well, when we have this inner dialogue with ourselves when we're considering something like AA, when we say, am I that bad? Or is my drinking that bad? And I know I was there, and when, you know, I went down the path of going to AA meetings once, and I woke up really hungover one morning and said, right, that's it. I'm going to call up and I'm going to find my meeting. And then I spoke to them, and somewhere along the line that the pub became more appealing. And it was all part of that journey. But in my head, I kind of have this sliding scale where, you know, at the top is straight jacket and padded cell. Underneath, it's rehab. Then under that, it's AA. And then under that, it's kind of thinking, oh, actually, you know, I'm just a heavy drinker. Everybody drinks. It's a stressful time. There's been a lockdown. And then you start telling yourselves all these excuses. But it sounds from what you're saying, PI, that you don't have to be hitting that rock bottom park bench, you know, last chance saloon to go to AA, that it's, as you say, it can be an amazing, pretty much free resource for anyone. Yeah. to get that feeling of belonging and support.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't drink 7 days a week. I didn't drink before 6 o'clock, because if you drank before six, you're an alcoholic. And if you drank after six, it was absolutely fine. You know, and I didn't drink on school nights, so-called school nights. But the reason I went, like I say, the anonymity thing really appealed, but, and I genuinely felt like when I went there that I was not an alcoholic, but I just needed some help, because what you mentioned earlier, you know, the dry January thing, I couldn't do it. I'd moved it to February anyway to make it easier. I couldn't. The first time I tried it, I got to 10 days without a drink, but I was climbing the walls and I was getting divorced at the time. So, you know, if you were getting divorced, you'd drink too, blah, blah, blah. Fast forward another year, and I'm doing dry February again, and I can't get to 4 days. And I'm slowly realizing that I just drink. If I'm in a good mood, I drink to get happier. If I'm in a bad mood, I drink to feel numb. And if I'm angry, I drink to calm down. And if I'm depressed, I drink to anesthetize. And you know, but basically I've got to the point that I'm just drinking, and I'm looking around for an excuse to drink. And 9 times out of 10, you know, I could trip over the cat and I'd use that as a justification to drink. But 9 times out of 10, I'd find the sodding cat to trip over it to make the excuse, you know. So that's where I was going. And the other worrying symptom for me was I was getting to mid-afternoon and really wanting to drink by mid-afternoon and thinking, why the hell is it not 6 o'clock yet? And I started clock watching. So I knew it was only a matter of time before I broke that barrier. So I knew that it was progressing. I knew it was getting worse. And I kept thinking, I just want to go back in time. I just want to go back to drinking how I used to a few years ago. And a few years ago, I could clock up days and days and days without drinking. And I just hadn't realized that there's these invisible sort of gates that you go through, and they're one-way gates. And once you've gone through that gate, you can't go back in time. So it is very progressive. And how it progresses depends on the individual. So, you know, you can be one bloke picks up your first drink at 18 and you're in rehab by 22. Or you can, there's women that I've sponsored and they haven't started drinking problematically for decades, and then all of a sudden they hit their 50s and the drink takes over. So everybody's story is kind of unique, and I always laugh because in AA I'm called a high bottom drunk, and I've never been a high bottom anything, so I think it's wonderful. But it just means I didn't drink myself basically to the gates of death. It just means I got off the train comparatively early, and lots of women do, to be honest. We for whatever reason we get picked up or we find ourselves, you know, dealing with problematic booze issues a lot sooner than the men do, if that makes sense. So yeah, everybody's sort of story is different.
Hi, we're Sound Rebel and we produce this podcast.
We make loads of podcasts and we want to make yours. Email hello@soundrebel.co.uk to find out more.
You forgot the bit about the first free episode.
Oh, and tell us you heard this ad and we'll produce your first episode for free.
Great. Email hello@soundrebel.co.uk now and we'll get back to you as soon as we can.
Right, back to the episode.
I'm loving your story. I think it's fantastic. And there's so much else I want to ask you about. Person irresponsible. Now, talking of irresponsible, if you don't mind me just picking up on something that you alluded to earlier, jet ski purchase. Wow. Can we just go over that briefly?
Yeah. I'd love to tell you more about what happened, but I honestly can't tell you a damn thing about what happened. I just woke up the next day, the proud owner of a jet ski. And I had apparently grand ambitions to jet ski around the UK. I had no idea if it was even possible. And became the proud owner of a jet ski. And the worst part of this story is my ego then says, you've got to give this a go. So I'm Googling it and no woman's done it. So then my ego says, you've really got to do this. And then that's when I found out only 3 men had done it, and 2 of them were Royal Marines and the other one was Bear Grylls. And I was like, oh, this is a disaster.
Oh, shit.
This is when you realise you probably have a drinking problem. Or I should have realised I had a drinking problem. This is years before I joined AA. And anyway, so there's so many terrible parts to the story. I bought this jet ski in the UK, but I was living in South Korea. So quite how that was going to work, I don't know. It got delivered to my ex-sister-in-law, who lives hundreds of miles inland. So she had this jet ski on her front lawn. And then I arrived in the UK. I was like, I'm not going to go jet ski around the UK. And I did it, unbelievably. I started just above the Thames. I went north around Scotland and I got just down to South Wales, and then Hurricane Katrina hit and I could never finish it.
You actually did it?
I am the first one to jet ski around Scotland, but I, alas, never completed the whole trip. But anyway, that, I should have realised then that I had a drinking problem, because that's just not normal behaviour. But what's really memorable about that trip is obviously I'm not a fit and healthy individual at all. So I'm going out to sea every day for sort of 8 to 9 hours on this jet ski, bounce, 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 bounce. I've never ridden one in my life before. And then I'm coming inland. I can't move. I'm in so much pain. And I remember I was in North Scotland and my former sister-in-law and her family were following us around. And she brought a bottle of Beck's, because I only drank Beck's beer because it was suitable for vegetarians, unless no other beer was available, in which case I couldn't give a shit about being a vegetarian. And she brought this bottle of Beck's and put it down in front of me. And I remember looking at it and thinking, I can't drink this. And my next thought was, see, I don't have a problem with alcohol. If I had a problem with alcohol, I'd be drinking that. I now know if I'm looking for evidence to prove I'm not something, it's a bloody good clue I am something. The fact that I'm driving a bloody jet ski around the UK is the biggest clue of all. So yeah, so those kind of really, you know, there are some hilarious drinking stories, and drinking was fun once upon a time, but alas, you know, it follows that arc of it. Yes, it was fun, but it starts to become problematic, and then the problems get bigger and bigger. So that's one of my more fun stories.
I knew you'd fit in well on Over the Influence. I knew this episode would be great. I'm stunned. I'm looking at Freddie's face. I'm looking at Ben's face.
I'm just thinking, I haven't drunk for a while now, but I'm just thinking New Zealand's an island, isn't it? And like...
Don't dare.
We talk about it. I think that there's nothing wrong with this idea. This is amazing.
The only thing I would say to you, Freddie, is just do it sober. You'll remember it so much better.
Well, actually, PI, you know, it's an absolutely nuts thing to attempt, first of all. I mean, obviously, you bought the thing when you were pissed and it turned up. It's bonkers that you then went, but I'm going to do it now. Like, most people would just go, is it a 30-day money-back guarantee on this? Like, how on earth am I going to get this jet ski back to the bloody, you know, your sister-in-law's pissed off because she's in Birmingham, wherever she is, with a jet ski on the front lawn. But you continued to do nuts things after getting sober because you've walked across America.
Yeah.
Where did that idea come from?
Oh, idiocy. Total idiocy.
So you can't blame the booze.
I think it's amazing. I'm in awe of you, yeah. PI. No, there's nothing idiocy about this.
I wholeheartedly lay the blame at a woman called Bex, and she had watched a film called Wild, and she kept badgering me to watch this damn film. And I kept
saying,
I don't need to watch other people having a good time, because then I get competitive and then I get envious and then I have to go. And she kept going on and on about it. So it's entirely her fault that I watched. She forced me to watch this film, and then she told me to go and read the book. And then, because I get very addictive very quickly, I read 6 more books about the Pacific Crest Trail, you know, in a week. And then this is where coincidence just knocks in. And one of the things, you know, we were talking about higher power earlier, I just stopped believing in coincidences. And that was how I sort of became more spiritual. It's like everything's the way it's supposed to be. And so I'm sat in the bath one day, and you know, most of us do this. We watch, go looking on YouTube for something to watch or whatever. And one of the thumbnails was how to apply for a PCT permit. I had no idea you needed a permit to do this. So I click on the link, and this guy is talking about how to apply for a permit. And I Google it, and there's only one day a year you can get the permit. And it was that bloody day at 6 o'clock.
No.
So, of course, I'm like, this is fate. This is God's will for me. So I run out of the bath. I run up the stairs, and I'm there naked, fat, all wobbly. You know, 5 minutes later, my thighs are still wobbling away, and I'm filling in all these forms, and I'm doing all these courses. I'm learning about fires, and, you know, they've got these rangers with massive shovels, and I'm thinking, I'm sure you don't need a shovel. You know, I'm learning all about how to go and live in the wilderness, and I have to do these 2 courses. 6 o'clock comes. I get ticket number 12,000 and something. And there's only, you know, I think 3,000 tickets available, but the system's a bit weird. So I end up with a really good ticket, like a golden ticket. So I was like, oh, crap. Now I've got to go walk across America. You know, and I don't walk. You know, I don't go anywhere without a car. So, yeah, so it's just another one of those absolutely bonkers things. But what I found really spooky about it was my divorce date, which had really probably is what got accelerated my drinking, was getting divorced and my marriage breaking down. It had really sort of had got me giving up on life, as it were, and it had taken me to some very dark places. And my divorce date is March the 17th. And then fast forward another year, and I join AA on March the 17th, and I fly to America. I was due to fly to America on March the 17th. So I was just like, this is so spooky. As it happens, with all the pandemic and all the chaos around that, I ended up flying to America a week early, and I started on my first full day on trail was March the 17th. I was just like, well, this is meant to be, you know? And so that's how I ended up walking across America. So it's all entirely Bex's fault. And Bex,
I'm really sorry, PI, that doesn't explain why you walked across America. I can't.
It makes perfect sense to me, PI. I get it. I'm on board.
It's just that I just felt this compulsion to go and walk across America, and so I did.
You've got to do it. And can you tell us, with we say walk across America, was it from where to where? How many miles was it? How long did it take you?
What's all the numbers? Canada. So I touched the wall, the infamous wall.
What?
Mexico to
get out!
In a northerly direction for 2,653 miles. And that's just the trail that links the two borders. You, of course, walk on and off the trail. And, of course, I get lost in my own living room. So I do hundreds of miles extra that you don't need to
Hang on. My head's starting to hurt. Let's just back up. How many miles?
2,653. That's door to door.
Yeah.
Dear God.
And then you've still got to walk on and off. Like, one of the times I had to go and resupply, I had to walk, you know, for a day and a half to get out of the wilderness, as it were. So there's all these extra bonus miles. And then I got lost.
There's so many questions. And you did this on your own?
Yes.
Completely on your own?
Yes. Well, there was a pandemic. Everybody buggered off.
And you thought, you know what, I'll just walk from Mexico to Canada. No biggie. How long did it take you?
5.5 months.
Yeah. Because Land's End to John O'Groats is, I'm just giggling it, that's just to kind of put it into context, just how far that is. Land's End to John O'Groats is 874 miles.
Yeah.
So that's three times. That's like going from Land's End to John O'Groats to Land's End to... Three times. What?
And here's the worst thing, is that you start at 4,000 feet and you climb up to 12,000 feet. Well, Ben Nevis is 4,000 feet. So you're doing Ben Nevis like three times a day. It's just, the whole thing's ridiculous.
And like, where did you sleep?
In a tent.
Like, was it like a Hilton or anything? Or...
Premier Inn, sorry. Freddie likes a travel lodge.
I do like a travel lodge.
I called my tent the Cling Film Castle because it was incredibly lightweight, but also quite see-through. So I slept in a tent every night, which gives you that false sense of security. You're not about to be eaten alive by, you know, bears and things.
So that was my next question, PI. There's so many questions. We've gone off piece now, but I don't care. One, were there any bears? And two,
yes.
How scared were you?
Very. But what I learned was that bears hate to be sung at, and I can't sing for toffee. And what I also learned about myself is when under considerable pressure and you have to think of something to sing, it's really hard. And the only thing I could think of singing was God Save the Queen. So there I am in the middle of the wilderness.
Wow. I mean, PI, this usually, these kind of conversations, we'd usually say something here like, and isn't it amazing the things that you do when you decide to remove alcohol from your life? But you did the jet ski thing whilst you were still drinking. Like, is there just something in you that has to take things to extremes, do you think? Is there something in you, like you did say earlier on, I get addicted very quickly. Like, is that just inbuilt? Is that just part of you? Were you born with that?
Well, AA promises that it'll restore you to sanity. And I think I am trying to prove AA wrong, you know, so I'm very defiant and I'm very determined to be unique, special and different. I think, you know, I am one of those people that is drawn to very bonkers things and can be a little bit dizzy at times. I mean, the probably my most embarrassing story is I got a job in Serbia. Well, I thought it was Serbia, but when I read the contract, it was Siberia. So I still went. And
oh, my God.
I am drawn to the slight quirk. And it's a case of, well, when things happen, just roll with it and see where it takes you. It's kind of fun.
You must have had this incredible sense of adventure already. As Ben's, you know, mentioned there, that was you. And I was going to say that perhaps drinking alcohol dulled that. It obviously didn't, because we've had the jet ski story. But do you find that you've become bigger and braver and more open to do absolutely anything? And the fact as well that you're doing this on your own as a woman, it's that in itself deserves celebrating.
Yeah, I think one of the things I've learned about myself, I never knew that I was riddled with anxiety. And I always have been my entire life. I had no idea. And I also know that there's quite an amazing piece of research done about children who grow up in adverse conditions, so adverse childhood experiences, I think. And the more of those you tick, the more likely it is you're going to be a dysfunctional adult. And I score 8 out of 10. So it's a given that I've got this inner lemming gene that just means I see a cliff and think, oh, I'll launch myself off it. And so it's that sense of, I'm coming to realize, because I always had this anxiety, I used to put myself in dangerous situations in order to legitimize how I felt. And it never, nobody ever told me about anxiety or ever asked me about anxiety. And so it's only now that I've got into recovery that I've learned to get to manage my anxiety, and I can actually just enjoy life now and learn to push that to one side. So I think some of it was to try and legitimize the fact that I was always terrified. And some of it is I genuinely love this stuff. You know, I hate it when I'm doing it, but I love talking about it afterwards when I'm back safe on my sofa. I think it's brilliant.
I think it's so interesting. Oh, sorry, Shazza.
No, sorry. All I wanted to say was, P.I., you make Freddie look relatively normal. Because we think Freddie has got, sorry to use this term, a screw loose. You know, he is really extreme with the stuff he does. Nothing half-assed. It's full on. And I can see Freddie sort of nodding his head in agreement to everything you said. Sorry, Freddie, carry on.
No, I was going to say that I love it. I love everything you say. And this is something that fascinates me as well. I know the author, Jenny Valentis, who we had on the podcast a few months ago, she talks about the link between doing extreme things and an addiction. And it's something that fascinates me, because I see that inside myself, that why did I hit alcohol so hard? And yet I have this desire when you say, when the jet skiing around the country and or walking across America, I just think brilliant. And why would you not want to do that? But I recognise that the people say we have a screw loose, which is fine. But what's your view? Do you think there's that link between extreme drinking and doing these extreme things? Or is it just your upbringing and the way that you are?
Well, we know from the research that, you know, if you have X number of adverse childhood experiences, we know that your propensity to either become an addict in some form, whether it's overeating or, you know, sex addiction or alcoholism or drug addiction, is far, far, far greater. And one of the other symptoms is extreme sports. So, you know, so it does push you towards the fringes. So there is a link, you know, and it's an established researched link, and it's been replicated and validated and so on and so forth. And I think one of the things, I've learned this in recovery about myself, because I had such a traumatic upbringing and that sort of thing, my comfort zone is chaos. So when the pandemic hits, I'm in my element because I love chaos, and that's where I feel best at. When things are humdrum and boring, that's my danger zone, because I can't handle it. I can't do boredom. And so learning that side of me means I'm no longer just this fatalistic idiot that, you know, looks at the cliff and thinks I'd like to jump off that. It's more like understanding, okay, this is how I am, and then learning about how to handle boredom and mundanity and all of that sort of thing. Because walking across America, I can assure you, is bloody boring for the most part. You know, you're just walking. And after a while, the views just become the views. You know, it's just like, whatever, you put a picture on your wall, eventually you stop seeing it. So I think there are strong links between sort of extreme behavior and addiction, and it's all about chasing that high. And you know, the high that I'd finished in Canada, spoiler alert, for 6 months after, was the happiest of my life, absolutely ecstatically happy. And then of course you fall off that bit and you get really depressed. But it's learning about your you know, that's where the 12 steps has really taught me about being able to sort of not just analyze to death, but being able to understand my own human behavior and how I function or misfunction in society and that sort of thing. But I do think there's very strong links. Yeah. Addiction. And I know in AA that, and I totally subscribe to this, to make us an alcoholic, you have to have two things. You have to have that allergy that I described earlier, this reaction to alcohol that means that one is never enough and nor is 1,000. But you also have to have this belief that alcohol is fun. And alcohol gives you, you know, makes you more adventurous and makes you more ecstatic, and it changes you. And it's that whole obsessional sort of thinking. So put the two together and you've got a fatal illness, because you've got a body that can't drink and a mind that tells you to drink. So I do, you know, there are strong links. But I mean, whether alcoholics are born or made, I couldn't actually tell you. I think it's 6 of 1 and 6 of 1 of the other.
Agree with all of the 12 steps and the whole philosophy around AA? Do you have to subscribe to everything, or can you find benefits in parts of it and go, actually, that bit I'm not so, that doesn't apply to me. But do you have to subscribe to it all from the off?
Well, first, no, absolutely not. I mean, if you read my book, you'll see how I had to deal with it. I did it very lightly. There's no have to. First and foremost, the great thing about AA is we shall never be organised, and we do a great job of not being organised at all. So there's no rules. There's no, you're not having to take on a philosophy. I fell in love with it through that process of just constantly being exposed to it. So most of us look at the 12 steps and you'll look at number 4 and you'll look at number 9 and go, no bloody way. And number 4 is where you actually sit down and take a long, hard look at your life and write it out and really, you know, confess all that you've done to somebody and just get all that shit out of you. Most of us shy away from that. And step 9 is the other big bastard one. That's where you go and say you're sorry to the people that you hurt. And that, you know, none of us want to do that. Nobody wants to go cap in hand and say, do you know what, I was a total twat and I'm sorry. And that's the thing, is that it's the only, you only do it when you're willing to do it. If you're not willing to do it, you don't do it, because there's nobody's in charge. There's no one, you know, if someone has a sponsor, they are just there to show you how to work the steps. They're not there to control your life. And if they are controlling your life, get rid of them, get someone nicer. There's no have to. And it's that sense of lots and lots of people go to AA, never get a sponsor, never work the steps. The only requirement to be there is that you have a desire to stop drinking. That's it. So, you know, take what you need, leave the rest. But the more you do, the better it gets, to be honest. Well, that's how I found it anyway.
This has been a complete whirlwind of an Over the Influence episode.
It didn't go the way I thought it was going to go.
And what do you think, Shaz?
Well, I don't know. I didn't quite know what to expect. I knew we were going to talk about AA, which I was really interested in. I've never been to AA, and I know a couple of people that have had experiences of it, but I really wanted to find out more about the whole process and the 12 steps. So I found that really, really interesting. Got to say, I found the jet ski story more interesting, and also that you trolled across America on your own.
Well, here's just to make a point about the fellowship. It's global. So when I actually had to get from San Diego, where I arrived, down to the border, AA gave me a lift down there. Do you know what I mean? And when I got to the first town to resupply, the lockdown had kicked in. But the second town to resupply, somebody from AA picked me up, took me shopping, took me to a meeting. And I had contacts all across America just through the fellowship.
That's
and
it's amazing.
That, you know, it's such a network now that I can go anywhere in the world, and within a couple of hours I've made contact with somebody. So I never have to be alone, or, you know, with this sort of crazy thinking, because we all know that when you start traveling, no one's looking, I can have a drink now, you know, those sort of things. So it is definitely the best thing I've ever done. But it's like everything else. You have to put your conceptions to one side. So if you've never been to a meeting, go to a meeting. You don't have to join. You don't have, there's no forms. You only have to go once. It's anonymous. No one's going to check up on you. And just go and, you know, go and see what it's all about. And I think the thing that gets most people, because it's the big thing that it grinds my gears, when you see AA in popular culture on TV, it always looks like you're sat outside the headmaster's office. So Freddie, you'll relate. You know, everyone's sat there really like, oh God, like I'm in so much trouble. And that's how they depict it on TV. When you actually go to a meeting, everyone's sat around. I mean, the chairs are pretty uncomfortable, but they still look like they're slobbing around in their own living rooms. You know, it's a really relaxed place. There's a lot of laughter. And there's, you know, there's just a lot of warmth to it. So it's, when you sit on TV, you kind of think, oh God, you know, that's like very churchy. And it's not like that in real life. There's a lot of laughter. I wouldn't go if I didn't laugh, to be honest.
I think that's absolutely key. And, you know, as you say, there is AA and every other group, it's whatever works for you, isn't it? But I think the key to it is connection and knowing that you're not on your own and getting rid of that stigma and getting rid of that shame. And actually, once you start talking to other people, it's like, yeah, I get that. I mean, I can't imagine there's many people, PI, that bought a jet ski and did what you did.
Well, I did once share it. I have shared it a couple of times in the meeting, and then people start talking about their own drunken purchases.
Yeah.
They talk about donkeys, horses and sheep, and it's like, well, I didn't do that. You know?
It's brilliant. It's been a really, really enjoyable chat. So you've documented all this. You've got a book that you've mentioned. Just... tell people where they can find out more about you, if you wouldn't mind, PI.
Absolutely. So the book is called Everything You Ever Taught Me, which charts my journey from the Mexican border to the Canadian border. And I actually talk about the 12 steps in it, because, you know, I talked about how those 12 steps kicked in and helped me get through the horror that was walking 2,653 miles. And how I deal with the God thing, and how I deal with, you know, the step nine thing, and which is making amends and saying I'm sorry. Because I am sorry, you know, I was a twat when I was drinking, and it took me a few years to realise that. And yeah, so it doesn't bang on too much about AA. It's not trying to convert anyone into AA. It just talks about how I use that, you know, the 12-step philosophy to cope with the loneliness and the hunger and the exhaustion and everything else that goes with hiking across a bloody big country.
PI, you've inspired me on so many levels. It's been amazing talking to you. I'm going to be getting your book. I'm having a little Google now for local AA meetings. I am going to go to an AA meeting and see what it's all about. I'm also having a Google for a New Zealand jet ski hire. Interesting stuff. So watch this space, everybody.
PI, we would love you to keep in touch with us and maybe back in, we'll say, 6 months' time, because God knows what you will have got up to. I, for one, cannot wait.
Well, who knows? We'll just see. You know, there's sort of rumbling in my stomach to go and do something, but I haven't got a clue what that's going to be right now. And as with all these things, you know, decisions. But we'll just see. But in the interim, if you could buy my book, the funds would help. So Everything You Ever Taught Me, available on Amazon and Kindle, but not yet audiobook, because, you know, time and money and everything else.
Thank you so much. You've been a real inspiration, and it's been a joy to chat to you. Thank you so much, and good luck with the next adventures.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Over the Influence is no longer just a podcast. Our online community is buzzing with people like you. Meet Katie.
So I decided to stop drinking back in 2020. I was fed up of feeling jittery and shaky, and the wake up at 3 a.m. in the morning, and life, I wasn't just handling it as well as I thought I could. So although I made that decision myself, connecting with Over the Influence and the people involved in it really did make a difference. The connection with the weekly Zooms and just people always being there for you that really understand what you're going through. If I could say anything at all, just get yourself a connection. It really does make a massive difference. And I want to thank Shazza and Ben and Freddie, who are just really down to earth, who fully understand and have come out of it the other side, and are just really, really inspiring. So a huge thanks.
So if you want to join us, go to overtheinfluence.co.uk and be part of the Sober Rebellion.